This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we give you another 100% virus-free program. As we talk with a professor who gave a talk on philosophy at the Jefferson County Public Library in Port Hadlock, this is a previously aired program, but philosophy is a fruit that never goes bad. And now, we go inside the Compass. Mike Van Quickenborn is a philosophy professor at Everett Community College and a lecturer with the Humanities Washington Speakers Bureau. He's currently touring with a presentation called The Good Game on the Moral Value of Sports. To this former sports writer, that sounded like a very interesting subject, but we were more intrigued by a lecture he brought to the Jefferson County Public Library in Port Hadlock. That one was entitled Seriously Funny, Humor, Film, and Philosophy. So tell us about your lecture topic. How did it emerge? Where have you been speaking? And how much money are you grossing on your world tour?
Yes, the money is... I'm not doing this for the money. No philosopher does philosophy for the money, for sure. Where did it emerge? Well, you know, I would say that this whole idea of merging film and philosophy probably emerged when I watched the first time I saw The Matrix. In that hail of bullets, I just thought this is a wonderful way to illustrate the key concepts behind Descartes and his Meditations on First Philosophy when he's suggesting all of reality, what we think is reality, might be a dream. And I thought, wow, this could be a really good way to bring philosophy to students that might otherwise not find it particularly interesting. So with that, I kind of then started a class called Philosophy in the Cinema and was teaching that for a number of years. And then I found out about this opportunity through Humanities Washington to become a part of their Speakers Bureau and kind of take a condensed version of that class, so to speak, on the road.
So what is it in your personal backstory that led you to combine film, humor, and philosophy?
Yeah, I've always, you know, appreciated humor from an early age, watching, you know, Three Stooges growing up. And
you're not old enough for the Three Stooges.
Oh, I'm old enough. I mean, yeah, on the reruns, certainly. And so just appreciated humor, came to philosophy as a way to look at questions that were really, you know, motivating me, that I was passionate about. And, you know, have always been kind of a film buff. You know, recently with the reboot of Star Wars, I was recalling my own, because I have small children, and thinking back to my own days when I first saw Star Wars and thinking I was probably about 8 years old and saw Star Wars for the first time at a drive-in theater at midnight, because it was like you couldn't get in before that. And so I've just always been exposed to lots of different films, and you know, that's been a big part of my culture. Yeah.
So an interest in film, an interest in humor, and where did the interest in philosophy originate with you?
Yeah, you know, I also have a degree in math, so I was kind of going that route in college at St. Olaf, and it was not too difficult to double major, and so I would take philosophy courses on the side. And I just found myself being more and more interested in the philosophy, less and less so in the math. And so for me, what philosophy enables me to do is really, since philosophy can be pursued with regard to any discipline, I don't have to have any limits. I mean, if I want to talk about the philosophical questions and issues in mathematics or history or film or sports, right now I'm teaching or have been teaching a class on sports and ethics, environmental ethics. I mean, there is no boundary there for the discipline. And I just find myself interested in all kinds of topics. And so it really suits me well for that. I would also say that I don't mind conflict. I like to debate or to argue. And I think I'm fairly good at sort of keeping an open mind to different perspectives. And so I think all of those things kind of help to be able to think about and teach philosophy.
Interesting. Yeah. I think that was probably one of the keys of my philosophy professor, was that he was open to argument.
Right.
Philosophy doesn't seem to be, like math, a place where there's hard answers.
Right. There should not be, I think, for sure.
Now, how important is humor to the message delivery system? Because you're talking about some complex thoughts, and how does humor mix in with that?
Right. I mean, certainly, like, humor has not been a tremendous proportion of philosophical discourse. It hasn't been found there very much. But especially today, when we see so many people sort of taking extreme positions, becoming just sort of frozen in a particular position, I think that humor can really break down barriers, lower defenses. And if you can't laugh at yourself, right, something's really wrong. And you're not going to be able to see other people's perspectives and appreciate them, maybe take something away from them, also hopefully share something of your own. But humor is a good way to get people to open up. And I think more than anything else, to do philosophy, you have to have some kind of an open mind, for sure.
I ruminate as you were speaking about the political process going on, the bizarre political process right now.
Yes.
And my thought as you were speaking was, if any of these could bring humor into their message would be much more receivable, I would think, regardless of the message.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, especially in the primary season, right? The groups that they're appealing to are so polarized that it, you know, people aren't feeling comfortable being humorous and so forth. Or if they are, I mean, the humor there is just sarcastic. And I think that it's a very different kind of humor that doesn't lower people's defenses and, in fact, maybe backs people up.
Sure.
So I would exclude that in what I'm talking about.
I think any, we're digressing a bit, but I think any candidate who appeared on Saturday Night Live and hit a home run in that venue with humor probably win a lot more voters than from any debate where they start screaming at each other.
Totally. I agree.
Yeah. So if there was a golden age of philosophy, it might have been the time of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. So who are the preeminent philosophers in the 21st century? Would it be screenwriters and directors or popular songwriters?
Right. Well, we will remember that there are professional philosophers still today who are trying to make a difference. But in terms of, you know, maybe trying to reach out to people who aren't enrolled in philosophy classes and don't have much of a background, I would actually put stand-up comedians right there at the top because they're trying to get people to have a different mindset at times, and they are good at opening people up to perspectives they hadn't considered before. I mean, certainly not all of them are in that vein, but certainly the ones I'm interested in.
Give us
more
some names.
So. Well, I mean, so for example, I mean, he's now retired, quote unquote, but Jon Stewart, right, was doing this. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, did a fairly responsible job of it because he was open to, he'd have guests on his show that, you know, had a very different political mindset than he did, but he would engage with them. So he'd be right at the top, Stephen Colbert, you know, the people who are sort of inspired by and at work like he does. John Oliver right now is picking up that mantle, I think, pretty effectively, as well as Trevor Noah in Stewart's place.
Yes.
So yeah, all of them for sure.
And you mentioned that there are professional philosophers today.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of professions were you thinking about in that vein?
Well, I mean, that teach in universities and colleges, community colleges. I mean, and I think they're tending to find or starting to find more venues to get philosophy in the public discourse. So you have a blog at the New York Times website called The Stone, where, you know, they'll have different philosophers come in and write a piece on all kinds of different issues. And I think it gets quite a bit of exposure. You also, I guess it's worth mentioning, something I've been involved with in the past. It was we call it a movement, if you like, but it's called Socrates Cafes. Mm-hmm. And this is something that, I mean, we might say was started with Socrates, but picked up here in the 20th century by Christopher Phillips. And it's just getting people together on a regular basis to propose a question and discuss it. And it can be about anything. And it's the people from the community, and they're not necessarily going to agree. And I think they're really doing the good work of philosophy as well. Yeah.
So it's not a dead art or perhaps even a dying art. It's just evolving.
It is evolving. I would say there are some distinct pressures that I am worried about. In our culture now, there's a big push for STEM, right? Science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
That excludes philosophy and the humanities more generally. And I have a lot of concerns about that. And I think ultimately, I know why people are pushing that in terms of helping people to achieve financial security, but that's not the end-all be-all of a society. And I think to ignore the humanities will in the end be quite dangerous. So I have those concerns.
We're talking with Mike Van Quickenborn, who is a philosophy instructor at Everett Community College and is also now doing lectures in the area called Seriously Funny, Humor, Film, and Philosophy. So from the entire spectrum of films from which you had to choose, how did you single out these among the wide choices?
Right. Well, I would say that with adaptation, I show that one first in the lecture, followed by Being John Malkovich, and then I end up with I Heart Huckabees. And I will just make a connection between adaptation to I Heart Huckabees, and that is adaptation really gets people to question, how can we know what's true? I talk to the audience and say, well, we all know about these films that begin with based on a true story. And of course, those films are attempting to make some claim upon what really happened or the truth. By the end of adaptation, though, I think we I hope, get some sense that it's much more complicated than that. That what we are seeing in any film has been filtered through lots and lots of people. And so by the end of adaptation, we might have this question as to, well, how can we really know what really happened in any given scenario? At the end of the presentation, we're talking about I Heart Huckabees. And in that film, I think it really pushes home the point that, yes, there are people who are in conflict in society that have very different attitudes about how to deal with the environment and things like this. And it pushes home the point that we need to be in dialogue with one another. We need to recognize our opponents as human beings and be able to converse with them about these difficult topics. And it's only in that kind of dialogue that we really make progress and that we would find, I would suggest, truth of the most important kind.
So here are some financial numbers that I got from the Internet Movie Database, which may or may not be completely accurate.
Right.
Intolerable Cruelty cost $60 million to make and lost $25 million. I Heart Huckabees cost $22 million and lost $10 million. Adaptation cost $19 million and earned just $2 million. And the most commercially successful of your film choices, Being John Malkovich, cost $13 million and earned $7 million. Now, we contrast that to the two big box office hits, Deadpool and Batman versus Superman.
Yeah.
Each grossed over $300 million.
Right.
And those aren't exactly intellectual fare. So is there no market for cinematic philosophy?
Well, people keep predicting the end of this run of superhero films, though after these kind of numbers,
yes,
probably it'll be another 5 years, I suppose. But yes, this is not mainstream entertainment, but there's definitely a place for it. And people will go out. I mean, these films made a profit at all. I mean, and sometimes in the millions of dollars says something. And at the same turn, you can have these mega blockbusters that will lose hundreds of millions of dollars or tens of millions of dollars at the very least. So it can go both ways. There are a number of independent filmmakers, and I point to foreign cinema as well as another really good source for thought-provoking filmmaking. What I like about the films that I chose for my presentation is that they're all American films. They're all definitely right there in the mainstream of American comedies. So they're very accessible, but still get the audience to think. So is there a market? I think so. And given the sort of increasingly fractured nature of distribution for film, I think it opens up more possibilities for more interesting films to be made rather than always having to rely on the mega blockbuster.
Now, your talk focuses on just four films, but what are some of the other mainstream films, films that folks may have heard of that sort of pack a philosophical punch, in your opinion?
Yeah, well, as I already mentioned, The Matrix clearly is the one that kind of got me started on this road, and to a lesser extent, the sequels to that. So in my presentation, I'm talking about Spike Jonze and Charlie Kaufman as a duo that was responsible for adaptation and Being John Malkovich. I Heart Huckabees is from David O. Russell. Another filmmaker, though, that many recognize as offering philosophically interesting films would be Christopher Nolan. Mm-hmm. Inception was, you know, as far as I remember,
fascinating film.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think fairly profitable, as I remember. And then, like I said, I bring in some foreign films. I'm kind of on the lookout for new films constantly. So another one here, this is another Spike Jonze film, but Her, about artificial intelligence. An older film along those same lines is Blade Runner that many people have seen.
Did you see Ex Machina?
I did see Ex Machina. Yeah, that's also interesting for me. And then again, Her is another one that addresses issues with artificial intelligence. Blade Runner is just particularly interesting. It's a slower film, at least by today's standards. We see Harrison Ford there. It's science fiction. We expect a lot of action, but it's a bit slower, but I think very philosophically rich, especially because the purported androids in that film are actually biological beings, and that complicates the picture quite a bit. So I still hold that one up as really a remarkable feat. I have a website, of course, as everybody does now, and I have like a whole filmography there where I've listed a bunch of like about 50 films and categorized them in different topics, philosophically speaking. So
tell us your website.
So it's just M as in Mike, VQ, dot Weebly, WEEBLY.com. And yeah, it's just available there. Yeah, and I guess if I could, I'll mention some foreign filmmakers who I really like, because the Dardenne brothers from Belgium. I'm Belgian, as I mentioned earlier, but the Dardenne brothers are always doing really interesting work. Their most recent film, 2 Days, One Night, is something I'm actually going to show. I'm going to be doing a festival of foreign film and philosophy, and that's one of them that I'll be showing, along with another recent Brazilian film called The Boy in the World. It's an animated feature that's also rich, I think, philosophically speaking, ethically speaking, more particularly. brings to mind a number of the Pixar films, I think, are very thoughtful.
Name one or two.
Well, Inside Out, right?
Yes, yes.
This idea that, you know, who are we? Well, we're composed of these different personalities in our head, so to speak, really, I think, makes us think about that whole theory. It is a philosophical or psychological theory, but it does, of course, a nice job exploring what that might mean. Wall-E, yes. An older film, definitely profound.
Interesting. Yeah.
So I really think those are worth viewing as well.
Now, you mentioned The Matrix. Well, when I saw The Matrix, it was one of those mind-blowing moments.
Yeah.
And I've watched the movies multiple times, all of them. Although I believe you're right. The first one is certainly the one that hits the home run. So yeah. What do you think the chances are that our reality is just a Matrix-like illusion, that we're playing out our lives inside a computer program? 20%?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you ask, right? Because, in fact, this person, his name is Nick Bostrom, Bostrom. You can, of course, find him on the internet. He has argued that given like just recent advances in virtual reality and computing power and whatnot, that future civilizations would be very likely to want to generate a virtual world and populate it with artificial intelligences and sort of experience those virtual worlds almost as like a reruns, like their version of That 70s Show or something like this. And given current human tendencies that, yes, that seems to be appealing to kind of relive past decades and past eras, he actually suggests that, assuming we don't blow ourselves up, this is actually likely that right now we are, in fact, living in a virtual reality and that we're maybe nothing more than an artificial intelligence ourselves. I don't buy it, but that is his argument, and it's certainly worth considering.
Is it the role of philosophy to ask questions or to come up with answers?
Well, yeah. I mean, I would certainly put the emphasis on the former. To ask questions is really the thing we should be pursuing for the most part. But when you ask a question, of course, you want to think about the possible answers. But of course, once you generate some possible answers, it just generates more questions and so on. So again, the emphasis has to be on asking those questions. Philosophers who decide that they have the answer, that leads to problems. And this is one of the reasons I actually like The Matrix. Of course, many people are familiar with The Matrix, and there's a character in there called Cypher, mm-hmm. right, who wants to actually be reinserted into The Matrix and wants to basically forget that he's living in an artificial world. And I always like to kind of challenge my students by suggesting that Cypher is really the hero of the film because Neo and company, I call them the Zionistas. Mm-hmm. What are they doing? Well, they're slaughtering lots of people in order to bring them to the realization of the truth. And guess what, everybody? The truth is that life really sucks, right? That the world has been destroyed and we're living in underground caverns. And Cypher's saying, look, what's so bad about the virtual world? As long as we're ignorant of what's quote unquote really going on, let's just, you know, enjoy it because it's a better world than this one. And so my point is, when people feel like they have the truth with a capital T, they are very willing to bang people over the head with that and mm-hmm. use it as a cudgel. And Neo kind of represents that, because when they're virtually killing all these people in the Matrix, we learn, right, that these people are actually dying in the quote-unquote real world as well. So I think that can be a very dangerous sort of approach to philosophy.
What really appealed to me about philosophy is that it opened up so many possibilities that I hadn't considered before, and it makes you think. Mm-hmm. It makes you go deep into areas that sort of lights up my brain in different areas and makes me feel good.
Right.
What doesn't make me feel good, and I was trained as a journalist, searching for fact.
Right.
It's hard to pin fact down in philosophy because it's a movable object.
Right.
Does that bother you?
It does not bother me. I can say that at one point in my life, it would have or it did. But, you know, contemporary philosophers, I'll mention Richard Rorty here. There are others in the American pragmatist tradition are going to say that, you know, maybe we need to sort of give up this pursuit of the truth with a capital T and look for what works, what will make progress, what we can get other people to agree with us about. And, you know, seeing journalism in that same light, I think you're looking for the best evidence. You're looking, you know, here's some good evidence. Doesn't mean you've got the whole story. It's never the whole story. It sure. can't be the whole story, but it's the best information we have. You're presenting it to an audience and they will, you know, do with it what they hopefully, you know, can in dialogue with people who might disagree with them. And then we can make progress because we're willing to compromise, willing to entertain different possibilities. So I actually think that philosophy is a great, you know, background for journalism because, as you said, you know, it opens your mind up. It makes you a skeptic. That's sure. very useful, too.
That's very important for any journalist.
Yeah.
Although I've found it infects your life for the rest of your life because people say, oh, you don't believe in anything. Well, I believe in the facts. I just need all of the facts. And I'm going to be skeptical until I know for a fact that this is truth.
Yeah.
And philosophy, I believe, is a search for truth.
Yes.
But it doesn't seem to ever end. You don't arrive at it and say, okay, we got it all solved now.
Right.
We don't need to write any more philosophy books. And I guess that's a good thing that it will continue on.
That's right. And we need to realize that.
So who are some of your own personal favorite all-time philosophers, any era,
right,
and why?
Yeah, so I just mentioned Richard Rorty, and I think, again, he's kind of what is known as maybe a neo-pragmatist philosopher. So I think the people who are behind him, William James, for example, John Dewey, these are people who are suggesting that we shouldn't look for this hard and fast truth, but we should look for what works and what makes a difference in people's lives, and a positive difference, we might add. Beyond that, I have a certain affinity for existentialist philosophers. People might know Jean-Paul Sartre, but really antedating him, Søren Kierkegaard in the 1800s from Denmark, I find really interesting. I have a particular interest in the philosophy of religion, and he has some really provocative, but I think also thought-provoking things to say in that area. So those are some people. And then really beyond that, I find myself really enjoying looking into different sub areas of philosophy and then drifting from one to another just to investigate all the different issues that might arise. Right now, I've been in pursuing and thinking a lot about sports and ethics, and then you're going to get a whole host of different philosophers who are interested in that topic. Mm-hmm. And then at other times, I've been, you know, looking at environmental ethics, and you have different philosophers in that area as well.
For much of my career, I was a sports writer.
Oh.
And I did a feature, an in-depth investigative piece on something that's, I guess, relatively light subject. But the question was about cheating in mm-hmm. sports.
Yes.
And several professional athletes told me, and they believe in their heart of hearts, it ain't cheating if you don't get caught.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you do
right.
to succeed to win, it's all good unless you get caught.
And that's really interesting, right? Because sports is used so much to teach people moral values. And then we have examples like this where we get to reflect on, well, what is morality all about? Mm-hmm. Obviously cheating in that context, but obviously cheating applies into all areas of life. And so if somebody adopts that attitude in sports, it's likely to carry over whatever they're doing. I think it's really worthwhile reflecting on those, like you said, sort of seems like a light topic, but it has actually some really interesting implications.
It's one thing if you're scuffing the ball or using some artificial substance to make the ball do something funny in baseball,
right.
or if you're taking steroids or if you're blood doping like Lance Armstrong. Mm-hmm. The scope of cheating, little things and major things, you know, at what point does it become wrong? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me in the professional athlete, mm-hmm. it's not ever wrong as long as you don't get caught.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
I'll move on. Is it true that you actually organized a philosophy film festival? Can you tell us about that? When and where? What films were screened? And did anybody come?
Yes, I've done it a couple times now. So back in 2008 and 2009, I organized the Philosophy in the Dark was the title. And so basically what that was is I invited philosophers from all over the Northwest to choose a film of their preference and come to Everett Community College, and we'll screen the film. And then afterwards, they'll talk about the philosophy that they found in it. And did people come? Absolutely. We had, I don't remember the exact numbers now, but upwards to 20 people, you know, per screening, which, you know, given a meager publicity budget, I guess I was pleased with. But we had, for example, you asked about films that were shown. So another one that many people will know is Fight Club.
Yes.
And that is, as well, a very interesting philosophically. It raises issues about identity because there's sort of a double personality kind of issue going on there. But the philosopher who came, he talked about how Fight Club is actually sort of a Buddhist fable or parable for, you know, a life in a Buddhist monastery and just the Buddhist outlook on life. And I thought that was really fascinating.
I'll have to look into that because I have the film. I've watched it several times, mm-hmm. and I went through a Buddhist phase of my own. Mm-hmm. And I'll look at it again with those glasses on, where are the Buddhist teachings hidden in here?
Absolutely, yeah. It's toward the end of the film when you have all of the people in the Fight Club living together. That's especially when you kind of see, oh, they're actually living together in this, like, almost a Buddhist monk-like community.
Monastery, yeah.
Yeah.
The great thing about films where philosophy has a through point or is a focus, whether you realize it or not, mm-hmm. is that multiple watchings bring multiple deeper realizations about it. Whereas if you're watching Superman versus Batman, they don't bear repeated watchings too often because you know what's going to happen, and it's just explosions and fights.
Car chases, explosions. Yep, things you've seen many times before.
Yeah. Is it true that your community, Everett Community College students get to watch movies in class?
They do, absolutely. I think that's actually important because...
And if so, is yours the most popular class on campus?
I wish that it were. It is not. It's an elective, so they can choose to take a class like that or not. And I tend to offer it at night because we require a longer class period. But I think it's important because you know then that the students have seen the film for sure, and they've just seen it, so it's fresh in their mind. So you can have some really rich conversations immediately following the film. So yeah, we watch the films in class. In fact, in that class, I give students, because it's basically like introduction to philosophy through film, introduction to philosophy, as I said earlier, you can talk about anything. And so I actually let my students choose the philosophical topics that we're going to do in any given quarter. And so then I have to adjust the syllabus and the film choices and so forth. But then they're, I think, also more invested in the class.
Where else are you going to be appearing in this area with this lecture?
Well, I'll just say that I encourage people to contact humanities.org, where you can find out how to book me in the area. But if you go to humanities.org, there's a way to find out about all the hosts, all the speakers, I should say, from the Speakers Bureau, and then contact the relevant people to get me to come to a library is usually where I've done it, but I've also done it at theaters and colleges.
It is a paid gig for you then?
Yes, Humanities Washington pays a speaking fee, and then whoever hosts me will pay to get me there, the mileage, ferry fees, that kind of thing.
So there is money in philosophy.
There is money, yes. It's not necessarily a lot, yes. But it's certainly it's worth doing either way, and I really enjoy it.
Get your pencil ready if you want to check out the website that philosophy instructor Mike Van Quickenborn mentioned, where you can download his personal list of books, websites, and films that have to do with philosophy. And Mike's website can be found at mvq.weebly.com. That's M as in Mike, V as in Van, Q as in Quickenborn, .weebly, spelled W-E-E-B-L-Y.com. For the KPTZ News Team, I'm David Cunningham.